Well, hey, Randy.
How's it going, Jim?
Going all right. I was wondering, what would you like to talk about today?
Well, this time on Physics Frontiers, we're going to talk about the five proven, or actually five of many, but probably the five most interesting proven methods of levitation.
Okay, and what are these methods?
All right. Briefly put, we're going to start with Lenz law levitation, which is Faraday's induction law, and we're going to talk about diamagnetic levitation and acoustic levitation, which a lot of people probably might not be familiar with, and optical levitation, including optical tweezers, which is a way that light levitates objects, and one that's been in the news recently that I think is really exciting, thermophoretic levitation, which is levitation by a heat gradient.
Okay, well, that all sounds really, really cool. Do you have any thoughts about levitation in general? You know, you sent me five papers for this, which happened to not correspond exactly with these five different things, but one of them was a very nice paper called Levitation in Physics by an E.H. Brandt. That was a science paper from 1989. Now, that paper was an overview of levitation technology. Do you have anything you'd like to go over as far as levitation technology in general at the beginning right now?
Well, levitation is one of the, I think, most exciting and mysterious, and for me, it was a source of my strongest inspiration probably for physics as a kid. You know, you'd read about levitation, and it was usually paranormal books and things like that. It was steeped in mystery. I mean, there was magnetic levitation for trains and that kind of thing, but, you know, as you keep your eyes out, as you're doing various hunting around online and so forth, you stumble across other levitation techniques, and you realize that there's quite a variety of ways that physicists know how to levitate objects, and some of them work in principles that most people aren't even familiar with that are really rather amazing, and so I thought it would be fun to talk about some of those so that people would have a one-stop source to go through the checklist on some of the most fascinating areas of levitation.
Okay, so now what are the big problems with levitation? I mean, as far as designing something that will levitate.
Well, usually with levitation, it requires an apparatus that will suspend the object inside of itself. So, you know, a lot of us would love to see a form of levitation that you could just unleash in your living room and have something levitate around the house. And that's a really difficult thing to do. Most of these techniques seem to be limited almost exclusively, but not entirely exclusively, to the domain of inside of an apparatus. And of course, the size and mass and so forth of objects that are levitated typically are rather small. Although in some cases, like with maglev trains, things can be levitated, you know, that are very heavy and moving quickly. But that's the exception rather than the rule.
I think there are a couple of things that are really interesting about this. One of the things that's really interesting is that there's a general theorem called Earnshaw's theorem. That was in the paper you sent me about the optical tweezers. So yeah, Earnshaw's theorem, and this is a theorem that I remember from somewhere, and I don't remember exactly where it is. I remember the content and the name, but I remember them separately. Reading this, I knew I'd read about Earnshaw's theorem before, heard about it before, and I assume that's probably in my E&M class as a graduate student. Basically, what that's saying is that if you have a bunch of inverse square forces, you don't get to balance things out perfectly in all directions. So you can maybe balance things in the Z direction, but then you'll have a transverse force. So you can't have a nice stable state just based on this 1 over R squared point source sort of thing. So if you're using an electrostatic trap, for example, it's always going to fail.
Right, unless there's some other agency involved. And methods that Brandt tends to focus on in his levitation and physics paper was an overview of forms of stable levitation that didn't require any special handling. But a lot of people have seen the little top, the little magnetic top that you can spin over a magnetic field, and the gyroscopic forces help stabilize it in the middle. And then there's some that have like a digital activated control so that it's always reading the position of something and compensating, so it's an active form of stabilization. The methods we're going to talk about have different tricky ways of providing mostly their own stable levitation.
Well, yeah, I mean, what he's talking about here is, far as stable is concerned, is something that is physically stable. Once you start having some sort of closed loop system where you're modifying the environment to keep everything stabilized, which is, I think, what you're talking about with that control, he's staying away from that because it's not just trickier. It's not really that interesting. It's like, you know, it's a difference between, say, balancing a basketball on your head and then poking it around with your fingers to keep it up on top, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you're not really balancing balancing it on your head if you have to use your fingers to keep it on.
Is that how they do it when they put it on their head? Is do they spin it so that the gyroscopic forces keep it aligned on top of your head?
By they, you mean...
people that can do that.
The Globetrotters.
Yeah, I guess the Globetrotters are the people that really own that.
You'll notice that they always do have it spinning, and it's on purpose, because otherwise it's probably not going to stay there, unless you have an exceptionally flat head. So Earnshaw's theorem, I think, was the most important thing, is that there are very few ways that are really, really easy to fix this. Now, one of the things we're not going to talk about is that if you have a AC electrical field, you can use that AC electric field to stabilize something. And that's in part because you have both an alternating force from the electric field, and once you start getting an alternating electric field, you end up with a magnetic field, and that adds some stability. And I guess the one other thing, I went to Washington recently with my wife, and we went to the Air and Space Museum, and they had place for the little kids to play around with a levitating basketball, and that levitating basketball was doing that aerodynamic levitation.
Where there's a flow of air coming up beneath it? Is that it?
Yeah, so there's a flow of air coming up beneath it, one, and two, it has to actually be at an angle. It has to be at an angle, and then what happens is you have a lift force as well as the pressure from the air, and that lift force is stabilizing the ball in there, and if it starts rotating, you also get a Magnus force that also helps stabilize it, and that Magnus force is the thing that lets you throw a curveball if you happen to want to throw a curveball, because I know you're a big baseball fan.
Yeah, never did that. We've all seen a good curveball, I think, in our time.
Most of us get one here and there. I think that's all I need for an introduction. Do you have anything else for an introduction?
No, I think that we should jump in and start getting into the nitty-gritty. We want to start with Lenz's law levitation. That's pretty much the oldest one, I think, that we know about.
Okay, so I guess Lenz's law levitation, that's fairly interesting. I looked up a couple of things with this. This particular paper that you sent me, Rethinking Faraday's Law for Teaching Motional Electromagnetism.
Yeah, that wasn't very good. I didn't have a chance to read it before I sent it to you. Sorry about that.
I mean, well, I found it extremely interesting.
Okay.
Now, part of that's because the way that it's going through and explaining some of these things is very similar to some of the stuff that I'm trying to talk to my students about. Although reading through this, I would never try to ask any of the questions on this little quiz that they gave to their students to mine. I'm afraid that I'd probably get as many correct answers as they did. They're getting like 4 to 11% correct on these questions. But I think the interesting thing about this is they're really getting into the strange things about Faraday's law. I guess it's not strange, but it's something that where you have to really start understanding physics behind Faraday's law, or behind what they mean by taking a derivative in this case, because it's a little different from what you normally think about. I was surprised when, on like the second page, they started talking about people complaining about this over, the last decade of the 20th century and the first of the 21st century, discussions on whether Faraday's law is valid for all cases. You know, you're starting to get a little worried because Faraday's law is one of Maxwell's equations. So,
yeah.
I'm sitting here saying, Faraday's law had better be valid for all cases of electromagnetic induction, because it is the physics of electromagnetism. It's the big connection between electricity and magnetism. There's a little bit of that also in Ampere's law. Faraday's law is how you get the magnetic field to interact with the electric field. If there's something wrong with that, then there's something wrong with just about everything we know about electrodynamics.
Right, and it turns out that it's mostly just a problem with how it's being taught that makes people think that it might not apply to various cases.
Yeah, I think it's actually a little deeper than that, because I don't buy most of their things. So, like, on this first question, they've got a falling loop of wire, and they're asking whether or not, there's any induction, and there is. But then they start saying, well, area has to be this funny thing that does not coincide with the area of your loop. You start thinking about it, and you just say, well, then how the hell do I know what area to use? And the answer is that area that they're making up is just a made-up area. If you go deep down into the mathematics, then you can see that fake area is completely superfluous. You don't need to worry about that fake area. But you have to go a lot deeper down into the mathematics than I think you should be comfortable doing with a freshman. And in fact, I was having just this problem. It's the same problem that you have with the electric current. So the electric current is the change in charge with time. It's the time derivative of the charge. That is one definition of the electric current. But if you look at, say, a wire, how much is the charge changing in that wire as current flows through it?
Yeah, you can only measure the voltage, right?
You can measure the voltage. The wire is not charging up.
Yeah, it's a current flow.
Yeah, so at any particular point, it's not charging up. It's a flow of the current. And so you have to sort of do some analysis, some physical analysis on the charge to get to the point where you can figure out what that derivative actually means. Because it's not really dQdt at any particular point on the wire. Instead, it's the amount of current flowing through that particular spot. If you look at, well, what is this dQdt? Say, well, it's, say, my linear charge density times distance. The Q is the linear charge density times the distance. And if I take the derivative of that, either it can be charging up, so I've got larger charge density at that point, or the charge can be moving through it at a speed V, right? dx dt.
Right, that's how I normally look at it. Yeah.
And the same thing's going on with this Lenz's law thing, which is that there's something in the definition of something that they call the directed area, which is part of Faraday's law that they're looking at, right? They're looking at the induced EMF is equal to the rate of change in flux. Inside of that rate of change in flux is something called the directed area. And so if you do an analysis on that directed area, you can figure out what it is you need to know about that situation. But you have to do that analysis. And because all of this has something to do with an integral over a cross product, you know, it's something that you can do, but it's a little bit difficult to imagine what you're doing. And if you have one lecture on this with a bunch of students who've never seen a bunch of that stuff before, you're never going to get anywhere, which is why they have four people getting that question right.
Yeah.
And actually, in their third year physics class, none of them got that question right by looking at it in the way that they're trying to get the students to look at it. They were able to figure out another way around it and find another rational bit. And they had a little more effectiveness with their fake maglev train, but not much. Now, how do you see that working? Because when I looked this up in a junior level electromagnetism for engineers book, that did something completely different. So how did you see this?
Well, let's start with the basics so that we're framing the picture and everybody's on the same page. With Lenz law levitation, there's a little experiment that I see on YouTube quite often when I'm looking up levitation stuff. And it's very simple. You just wind some insulated copper wire around into a spool a few inches in diameter, and then you run an AC electrical current through it. And it would probably be a good idea to put like a load on it, like from a house lamp or something, so that you don't burn the coil, because people are burning these coils and melting the insulation, and that's really dangerous. So you take that and you put it over a conducting surface, and it floats, you know, it levitates above that surface. And it does that because when you've got a conductor near a changing magnetic field, the conductor induces an opposite current that will generate an opposing magnetic field so that it wants to resist approaching it, you know. So it'll hover. That same principle can be used for levitating trains and things like that. And you could even do that, for example, over a saltwater body like the ocean, because the saltwater is conductive. So you could create a levitating force over the ocean. And one of the things that really caught my eye recently was that this is a really old law of physics. This goes back into the early 1800s, because that's when the advent of electromagnetic science was happening.
So the way that I saw this in the Applied Electromagnetism book was they use something called a image current. And an image current just says that if you have, say, a perfect conductor and you have a current loop above it, then because there should be no flux going through that perfect conductor, you're going to have an image current on the other side that's going to sort of try to repulse all of the flux through the conductor. And so basically, you know, if you have a current loop, you end up with a magnetic pole pointing downwards, right? If you have a current loop in the XY plane, you have, say, a downwards or possibly an upwards magnetic pole. And then in the stuff under there, you have a image current that's going in the opposite direction so that it creates a pole going the opposite direction. And so then everything cancels out at the surface of the conductor. That's your perfect conductor. And so that's the way they were explaining the maglev train. The big problem with that is that there's an efficiency problem, and that efficiency has to do with the conductivity of the material. And so because your conductivity isn't infinite, right, the resistivity isn't zero, you're going to have a reduced effect.
And this is why they use like superconductors. Is this why they use superconductors for the really high-speed trains, levitating trains?
Probably. I don't know enough about where they use it, but if they use the superconductors as the rails, basically, then yes, that's exactly why they do it. If they're using them on the trains themselves, then they're using the superconductors to get a really, really high magnetic field, because you can get a larger magnetic field from the superconductor. The cooled superconducting coil, you can have a much larger magnetic field from than from an iron core magnet. And in fact, you can get many, many times that. So 5 or 6 times, probably. So those are the two possibilities. I'd suspect it would be the latter, because that's one you can turn on and turn off when you need it, rather than having to keep an entire rail track cooled. You can just cool the things that are on your train. I don't know, but I'm guessing.
Do you think that they're employing the Meissner effect to repel the magnetic field lines of the magnets in the rail?
I think they're just getting these image currents. I think that's probably what they're doing. Of the different possibilities, I think that's the one that's going to be the most reliable. But I don't know. If they were cooling down the rail to low temperatures, then maybe so, though.
Well, I mean, I was just thinking, isn't a superconductor exposed to a magnetic field? I mean, isn't that going to create your ideal image current? Or am I misunderstanding the image current?
Well, you're absolutely right. To get something that acts like a perfect conductor, what you use is a superconductor. The issue with that is you have to literally cool the entire rail down, and it has to be cool to a superconducting level by the time your train gets there.
Okay. I guess I was envisioning it the other way, where thought that they had like electromagnets in the rail, and then they might have the superconductor on the train, so that you just have to keep it, you know, cold on the train.
That may be. So, but, you know, from what I was reading, it sounded differently, but what I was reading were pedagogical texts. I could be completely off.
Well, still, in just terms of theoretical, one of the things that I love about the Lenz law effect is that it's proportional to the frequency and the amplitude, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a really high frequency alternating magnetic field and you expose something like a superconductor to that, you can get a really powerful force.
Yeah, possibly, but then you have to actually create the really high frequency
alternating magnetic field, yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's also the common classroom demonstration that everybody knows and loves, where you drop like a neodymium magnet down through like an aluminum cylinder or a copper cylinder, and it goes really, really slowly because the induction laws, if I understand it right, as you drop the magnet through that tube, the current in front of it is moving in the opposite direction, and the current induced behind it, let me think about that, is moving in a way to oppose the change in the field. So it's like attracting from behind while repelling from ahead. Is that right?
Yeah, something like that.
It's a great effect, though. I love the idea of finding new ways to play with that.
Yeah, you know, this is something that everybody's used to thinking about it. Although, how many real commercial maglev train systems are there? I don't think they're really cost effective.
Yeah, I think there might have been one in France. I know there's one in Germany. They were talking about putting one in Texas, I think, but I don't know if that one ever happened.
I don't think so. I think there was one in China. Was that true?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, there's a high-speed one there.
There have been a lot of people that have built small tracks in different places, but they don't really use them in a lot of places. I think it's cooler to have a levitating train than it is really useful.
Right, unless you want to go really long distances and really fast and you have a ton of energy that you don't mind spending a bunch of money on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in that case, it's all right.
Well, all right, let's move on to diamagnetic levitation, and let's talk also a little bit about a superconductive levitation with a Meissner effect and flux pinning, because that's really cool stuff.
As far as diamagnetic levitation, you're just talking about the frog, right?
Sure. Everybody's seen the frog, and I wanted to talk about that because a lot of people don't understand how that works.
This particular experiment was done by the same guy who invented graphene, and in much the same way. Oh, I mean, he didn't just, you know, take some tape and stick it to a frog and call it levitation, which is how he invented graphene. Well, he didn't stick tape to a frog and get graphene.
Let's hope not.
He took tape and you know, stuck it on a big thing of graphite and pulled it off and got a two-dimensional thing called graphene. Now it's a really hot topic in physics. That may be dying down by now because they've figured out more advanced materials. But still, it's a nice simple system that people can play with and do lots of fun things with. In this case, you know, his group had a really powerful magnet, and they decided that the best thing to do with that really powerful magnet one Friday, which is the day they did weird things like stick tape to whatever it is they can stick tape to. Yeah, they decided the best thing to do on that Friday was to stick a frog in the really powerful magnet and see if it would float. And it floated. So that's basically what you got, is that they were able to take a frog and make it float in a magnet.
But the weird thing is that most people don't realize that water is diamagnetic, at least a little bit.
Everything's magnetic. And everything's a little bit diamagnetic, because diamagnetism comes from your atoms. So diamagnetism is a reaction by your atoms to the magnetic field, not so much different from what we were talking about just a second ago. What's basically happening is you've got a magnetic field that's incident on your atom, and then your electrons in your atom react to that by creating some angular momentum that opposes that magnetic field. And so you get a magnetic polarization or magnetization in whatever object you put in a magnetic field that tries to oppose that. So that's one of the two broad categories of magnetism that's out there. And it's usually fairly weak, but if you have a 9 Tesla magnet, then maybe it's not so weak anymore if you've only got a little frog. Might not work on a big frog, but it probably worked on a little.
Yeah, it was a very tiny borehole. I remember from the photographs, it was only like an inch or something, so they need a little guy to fit in there.
Usually on those things, they don't have a lot of room if you're getting a really high magnetic field, because you need to get your pole caps really close. Or in this case, it may not have been pole caps. I'm not sure what kind of magnet it was. It probably wasn't one of those ones that they've got at the National High Magnetic Field Labs, where they take an iron core magnet and spin it around really, really fast, in which case you can get really high magnetic fields, but I'd expect it's pretty scary.
Oh, I didn't know that they did that.
I think that's one of the things that they do down there in Florida.
But you need a magnetic field gradient, right? So that it'll float. It'll be sort of be repelled by the higher gradient and be forced to the area of lower magnetic field. Is that right? Because if it was a uniform field, it wouldn't make any levitation, right?
That's right. It has to be a gradient field, because you only have a magnetic dipole. If it's magnetic, it has to be a non-uniform field to produce
it. I'm a little confused, because it seems like, how do superconductors fit in with this? It seems like a superconductor is almost like a perfect diamagnetic material. Is that the right way to look at it? Because, I mean, there's experiments that you see where they, what do they do? I guess you can do it either way. Like, you can have a superconductor and put liquid nitrogen on top of it to cool it down so that it becomes superconductive. And then they put, like, a little neodymium magnet, and that you can levitate it right above the superconductor, and it'll just hang there in midair because of this flux pinning phenomenon. Apparently, there's imperfections inside the magnet. Is that what's going on?
Imperfections inside the magnet.
Actually, maybe it's the superconductor.
What'll happen is that a superconductor will create a real current that's trying to oppose the magnetic field, so that the magnetic field won't penetrate into that superconductor, because it's a perfect conductor. And so that current creates a magnetic field, and that magnetic field is felt by the original magnet. And since it's going in the opposite direction of that original magnet, and it's got that gradient as well, it basically pushes that magnet up. I don't think that turns it into a perfect diamagnetic material, because the effect is just completely different. You're looking at something that's more like Lenz's law than something that's like a diamagnet.
Have you seen the amazing videos on flux pinning, where they will like put one of these little neodymium magnets near the superconducting material, and there's some kind of phenomenon where some kind of imperfections, I'm not sure if it's, I guess it's in the superconductor, will allow, I guess, a magnetic field line to couple with it. So it'll still repel, but there's just like one or two field lines that are connected. So it'll hover in midair at a weird angle, and it'll act like it's stuck there, and you can move it to different areas around the superconductor, and it'll just hang there as if it's embedded in sand. And sometimes you can even like spin them, and they'll spin in midair. It's really crazy. Have you seen that stuff?
No, I haven't. Yeah, I'd expect that if you have a large enough superconductor, you should be able to do stuff like that. But I haven't seen that, and I don't know the actual reasons for it.
Yeah, so it's really neat. Apparently, if you get the right kind of pinned flux lines, you can even make the little magnet like orbit around the superconductor and do stuff like that.
Oh, that would be kind of awesome.
Yeah, At the end of one of these papers, which was it? It might have been the levitation and physics paper. I think at the end he talks about it a little bit, and he's totally obsessed with it. So he like spends like the last page talking about it because it's such a neat effect. But let's get on to the really, what I think is almost magical types of levitation. I was totally obsessed with acoustic levitation for well over a year because it just works on such a novel and fascinating principle. Do you want to talk a little bit about acoustic levitation?
Well, I mean, I don't know too much about it. I mean, you know, other than what I read, which is basically that, you know, you're able to take a vibrator and, well, I shouldn't say that.
An oscillator.
So you vibrate a source, right? Probably with some sort of speaker thing like PZT. And then you have like a concave reflector. And that'll set up some standing waves between the reflector and the sound source, and the number and how large they are and stuff like that depend on the frequency. But apparently it takes a fairly high frequency to do this. I'm not sure if it's necessary to do that, but it's probably much nicer to have a much higher frequency than you can hear when you're doing this. I think he was saying something like 3,260 hertz was what he was talking about. He's also saying that, you know, some people did it at a higher frequency as well, but this was Brandt again, I believe. And, you know, that force as a standing wave proportional to the ratio between the size of your object and the wavelength, because it kind of gets trapped in these little regions of, I guess, a negative pressure gradient. Is that what it is?
Yeah, there's this region between the node, which is where the waveform is like static, and there's like no sound at the node. And the antinode, where there's this high pressure region where they're constructively interfering. In that gradient, there's this upward pressure, and you can float an object in there. It's tricky because you've got to get an object that's like a quarter of the wavelength of the standing wave to get the ideal amount of force to levitate something. Depending on the size of the object, you need to tune your apparatus and use a different frequency and all that stuff. But you can get amazing results with it.
Well, yeah, and you get these things floating around. I think he was saying in there that to do this really, really well, what you have to do is you have to get the vibrating stand as close to your reflector as possible. But nobody wants to do that because then you can't see the little floaty things.
Well, one of the ways they got around this, and there was a number of patents that you can find on Google Patents by a guy named Martin Barmatz, and he was a JPL scientist, is he created an Helmholtz chamber that would contain all of the acoustic energy. That also helps quiet it down a bit so that you're not exposed to these incredibly powerful sound waves. A lot of his experiments were in the acoustic range, you know, between 20 and 20,000 hertz, so you still want to wear ear protection even with a Helmholtz chamber going, but then you can make larger objects like a styrofoam cup and stuff like that levitate. And you can see some videos by Dr. David Deek on YouTube where he was doing this stuff at NASA. I even ran across in a paper somewhere online, it was a Navy research document, and they said they were talking about they levitated a freaking cannonball in some giant steel room using a high amplitude wave setup. And I imagine they must have had to increase the density of the atmosphere substantially in that chamber to do that. But it's amazing to think that you could get an energy gradient that severe that you could, you know, you can levitate iron, you know.
I guess if you just want to pull the submarines out of the water, that's the way you do it.
That's one of the things that you see in the patents, too, is that there's also these sort of side fluid flow forces going on that stabilize it in the center of the beam, is that you can transport stuff around just by setting up the equipment properly and modulating the phase of the sound so that it will actually move like a conveyor belt through the midair on a region of lower energy in the air, you know?
Yeah, I can see that, yeah.
It's really cool stuff. So that was what I loved about acoustic levitation is I'd never seen anything like it before. Normally, you've got one force acting against another force to create some kind of balance, or you've got radiation pressure. Like even with acoustic radiation pressure, if I blow a lot of sound at you, you will feel it as a force and it can push objects around. And here was something that was nothing like that at all. You could put the source of the sound above the object and reflect it down off of the reflector below like you described, and it would hover near the node of the energy. So I just thought that was really magical.
Well, I mean, that's obviously just sort of a resonance phenomenon, and resonance is a little bit magical.
And I think that the optical levitation works in a similar way, but it gets more complicated with that, doesn't it?
I don't know that it's more complicated than that, but yeah, I mean, that's pretty much the idea with the optical tweezers sort of idea. You know, you can do this in either of two modes with the optical tweezers. You can set the optical levitation up by having a laser beam pointed straight up and just having it counter gravity, but I'm not sure how stable that is. I mean, both this guy and Brandt mentioned that you could do this just by pointing things upwards. This is Arthur Ashkin. Arthur Ashkin is the guy who wrote Optical Trapping and the Manipulation of Neutral Particles, which is sort of a review he gave for the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 1997. Both of them said that was perfectly fine. That was one way to do it. But I guess the optical tweezers let you also do a little bit of manipulation as well. I mean, it's actually very interesting because you have, at least in the description that he gave, you have to have sort of like basically two beams of light going through your particle. And then the way they interact with that particle creates two different forces. One that's pushing away from your optical source, and one is a gradient force that's pushing inwards towards the center of the laser beam. So it's trying to push towards the center of that Gaussian beam.
That's the part that kind of blows my mind. You'd think that since the object gets pushed away from the source of the laser light, that it would also get pushed away from the center where it's brightest. But I guess because of the refractive properties or the index of refraction, I think he was talking about, depending on the material, it'll get drawn into that energy center.
It really depends on the size and things like that. But what's going on is that, you know, he was talking about basically a transparent or object, is that when the beam hits the side of the bead, it reflects off of the tangent plane to the bead, and not so that it first goes in and then twists out a little bit later. And so rather than being pushed away from the center, it has two interactions, one when it goes in and one when it comes out. And that one where it comes out is at a much higher angle. When it now goes out of the sphere, pushing more in than it pushed outwards when it originally hit the sphere.
I see. So it changes the direction of the photon, so the momentum transfer goes in the opposite direction. The bummer about optical levitation and optical tweezers is that it only seems like it works for very small things, but that seems to be really handy, especially in some areas of physics and biology, because you want to handle really small things.
Yeah, I mean, it's perfectly fine for working with small things, and that's what it's designed for. I don't see any major issue with that. I mean, unless you can get a laser beam with a wavelength of 2 meters, then I guess, you know, if you want a quarter wave 8 meters, then you'd be able to levitate your bicycle.
Well, you'd need an awful lot of power, though, wouldn't you?
But then you'd have a levitating bicycle.
Who doesn't want a levitating bicycle in the living room? That would be pretty...
It is really interesting that that force gradient is inward.
So I think this is the technology that they use at the Large Hadron Collider in order to trap neutral particles they want to study. And this came up in some papers that I was reading about. They're going to study the properties of anti-hydrogen. And so with antimatter, of course, you can't let it touch anything. So you need something that you can use in a vacuum that will hold it in place so that it won't annihilate against the sides of your chamber. And so they've got these methods using this form of levitation and these kind of optical beams where they can cool down the particles. So they move really incredibly slowly. Like he was talking in this paper about, you know, I think fractions of a Kelvin. So you can cool them down really far and then hold them in place.
Well, I mean, it wasn't just fractions of a Kelvin. He was talking about millikelvins.
Like thousandths of a... Oh, boy.
Or not millikelvin, microkelvin, I'm sorry.
Damn.
So he was talking about, it was originally 240 microkelvin, and he thought that was going to be the limit, because he's going about this sort of historically. And then they were able to get down to 10 microkelvin instead. It's probably gotten a lot lower than that.
Oh, that's right, because he was talking about, like, you're at a quantum level at this point. They're studying stuff.
And this is how you make Bose-Einstein condensates and stuff like that.
Oh.
You know, by tricky manipulation of this stuff, you can figure out ways to get the 240 microkelvin, lower than the 240 microkelvin. So what they've done is, according to this, you know, they switch it off and turn it back on. And so if you switch it off really quickly, then all of the really fast particles run out, and then you switch it back on. Now you have only slow ones left.
Ah, so you're isolating them by their energy. That's smart. Okay.
I was wrong. They even figured out how to get down to one
nanokelvin.
I think we've gotten to nanokelvin today, but he mentioned the 1 microkelvin in 1997.
1 microkelvin. Okay. Still.
Yeah, it's been 20 years since this paper, so I think they probably have gotten much, much lower. I think I've heard nanokelvin previously, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, they're going to try to trap anti-hydrogen this way, and then they're going to see if they can detect if it falls up or down in a gravitational field, because they don't know for sure if it does that yet.
Yeah, they've been talking about that since I was in college.
I know, and they are always like, well, next year we're going to have that figured out. And it's always like another year and another year beyond that.
I mean, as long as it works for somebody.
Eventually it will. I'm just dying to get those results. So this was a really good paper, actually. This guy worked for the research department at Bell Laboratories. And if I recall correctly, Bell Laboratories, they invented the first transistor, didn't they?
Yeah.
Still going strong.
Yeah, and if you look at my Physics FM, I wouldn't say logo, but avatar, that's what that is.
What is what?
It's the first transistor made on silicon.
Oh, shit, I didn't know that.
Because I happened to have it in a presentation and I needed something, so I...
Cool.
That's what that picture is on the Gmail account that goes with my Physics FM account.
All right, now I know. Thanks.
Any other interesting things with optical trapping? Have you been talking to Randy Duran at LSU?
No, that was about it. I just wanted to cover that because it's neat being able to levitate stuff with light. Most people don't even know about that. It's pretty cool you can do it. I guess it wasn't possible. He said that it wasn't really possible until we got lasers, right? Because you needed a coherent light.
Yeah, you need coherent high power light sources, and you just don't have those on... Well, you didn't have those on Earth until they created lasers. So previously, they'd only worried about stuff like this in like stars.
Right, radiation pressure was only really relevant to astronomers and stuff. I love how we keep harnessing the laws of nature.
And people who make little kids' toys, like those little propellers and light bulbs.
I'm not sure I know what you're talking about. Oh, wait, you mean that little thing that spins around when the light hits on it? It's, like, I don't know if that's a Crookes something or other, or...
I don't really know what it's called. I remember I used to sell them at the game store. I was told that they go backwards because they don't have a really good vacuum. So rather than going in the direction the light is hitting them, what happens is that...
The heat is pushing them around. That's so disappointing. And they move pretty fast, too. So you're like, ah. Oh. All right, so let's get into the next one, which is the one that's been breaking in the news recently, even though the paper dates back to, like, originally, I think, 2015. The concept of thermophoretic levitation.
I think this paper was first published in APL this year, right?
It was, but I found a copy of it on archive that dates back to like 2015. Maybe they've updated it, I'm not sure, but it was only recently coming out in all the science news sites.
Well, I mean, if it was first published in a journal this year, in Applied Physics Letters, then it's been making its rounds in the review process.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Well, yeah, it's only recently officially published and gotten through, you know, the peer review.
Well, okay, good. Then we're right on the cutting edge here with this program. So this is a really freaking fascinating form of levitation. Did you enjoy reading about this? The paper was called Stable Thermophoretic Trapping of Generic Particles at Low Pressures.
Well, I mean, with a title like that, I know why you were attracted to it.
It's just so sexy.
It was kind of interesting. So what they had to do was they had to create a thermal gradient, and they did that by basically filling something with liquid nitrogen and then having something that's more or less at room temperature, actually probably at the temperature of ice below it. I think it was 277 or something.
Kelvin, you mean, yeah.
And then they had some sort of thermal gradient there, and these different things would levitate at different places. Weren't they just looking at the, they weren't just looking at it, but they were looking at, like, the little water droplets that were condensing on the stuff.
Yeah, one of the things they levitated was the little flakes of ice that formed on the receptacle for the nitrogen above. And then they just kind of knock on it, and the ice would float down and hover between that and the warm plate.
That was interesting. They just looked at that thing and watched them floating. It also looked like they had to have some sort of... I'm not sure if it was necessary to have the particular shape that they were looking at, but it seems like they needed some sort of X gradient as well. It seemed to be important to them to show that there was an edge near where they were levitating things. I'm not sure how important that was.
I know that they talked about, and there was a couple photos of them levitating those little spheres, these little hollow glass spheres, I think. And they also did Lent and all kinds of weird stuff like that. But I mean, this is a...
What I'm wondering is how important was it that they were levitating these near the edges?
Oh, I see what you mean.
So it looked like this wasn't like deep between two large plates where you'd have a uniform gradient in that sort of XY plane. It looked like they were doing it at some point near the edges where the gradient was sort of a little bit twisted around and trying to go sort of outwards.
Yeah, it's like the gradient creates like a little dish shape. And I guess they kind of roll around in that disc shape area.
That's sort of what it looked like. I mean, and that sort of reminded me of the aerodynamic levitation that needed to have multiple things going on to keep it stable.
Yeah, I think the geometry helped them on this because they used a smaller diameter cold receptacle above and a larger, wider, like basically room temperature plate below it. And I think something about that geometry helped them keep it centered.
Possibly. That's actually quite likely. So yeah, they have this thermal gradient that's keeping everything in place, which is pretty nice. And it's fairly interesting that the force on this has something to do with the most probable speed of the air molecules, for example, as well as the thermal conductivity of the gas. But the really important thing is this weird dimensionalness that has something to do with the ratio of the mean free path of an air molecule to the size of the sphere that's floating, the size of the floaty thing. I'm not sure why, but they didn't really write the condition in a very meaningful way. What seemed to be a meaningful way to me. So this condition for floating, the way they wrote it, was fairly complicated. And then it looks like it's just the fractional change in this thermophoetic parameter should be greater than 1/2 the temperature. But they've got something that's really big and scary.
Yeah, that's why I'd love to see if I could get your help trying to figure this out, because looking at this, and they did this at low pressure, like they were in the range of like 1-6 torr, and atmosphere is 760 torr. So I'm getting the impression that was somehow facilitated this levitation. Is that the impression you got?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it facilitated the levitation or facilitated the stability, because the big thing is that when these guys hit, when these little air molecules hit, this stuff's supposed to stay in place. But, you know, when you're using small things and then they're being hit by whatever, if they have a lot of things hitting them, possibly it knocks them out of the way.
Yeah, they said something about the hydrodynamic regime, which I gather is the, like, the denser atmosphere regime, that is somehow less conducive to the levitation, and that's why the little particles tend to not move up all the way to the cold plate, and why they don't move too far off of the hot plate, because the density, I guess, around it and at the top is higher.
I guess it's possible that you might not get as much of a gradient if you've got enough stuff there. I'm not really sure. But yeah, I mean, you have to have some sort of pressure change there as well, based on the fact that, you know, you have a density change. You know, there's an Earnshaw theorem here too, right? So it's impossible to stably confine a particle based solely on the temperature gradient. So you need something extra in there as well. So you might need that pressure gradient as well, and you might need that pressure gradient to match. So that, you know, you want to tune that difference in temperatures to the difference in pressure, or vice versa. Again, I don't know what the necessity for the low pressure is. I think that's for stability. And it might be that the high pressure increases that thermal conductivity more.
But it did say here that the thermal conductivity of air increases with temperature.
That's what I'm thinking. It says here that, you know, that thermal conductivity is good because it increases your force, but that would also increase the temperature flow between basically different strata of your air, so that the temperature flow from 5 inches to 6 inches would increase, and so you'd have a harder time keeping the temperature gradient, because the temperature gradient is probably exponential. Well, this looks pretty close, doesn't look too close to linear, but it looks pretty close with what they've shown. I think the heat transfer through air, if you're using conductivity, should be linear, and that might be an issue. The heat transfer should be a linear differential equation, which would have an exponential solution, so it would go like e to the or e to the minus x or something like that. So you'd start with one temperature and you'd go exponentially towards the other temperature. However that actually works, might be a hyperbolic tangent, something like that.
Yeah, I was thinking that if you had like, I'm basically thinking like two parabolas facing each other and sealed around the edge, with some kind of insulator, maybe in the equatorial plane where they join together, and then you could somehow maybe actively keep the top cold. That's where I really got stuck, is how do you cool down the surface of the top of this thing actively so that it remains really cold, you know, so it doesn't just warm up.
I mean, they've got electric coolers. They've got solid-state electric cooling technology. So you could just put a whole bunch of those around there. So you'd have to get some thermal paste, and then you'd stick a lot of those little things around your object, and you could use that. Probably the easiest way is to just get a big doer of liquid nitrogen and then pour it all onto the top one. That would, for a while, stay there. I mean, especially if it was thermally insulated around the edge, that would, for quite a while, stay there. I don't think you'd boil it off too quickly. I'm not sure exactly how quickly, but if you don't have a really good thermal contact between the two sides, we could probably do an experiment for 30 minutes to an hour.
Well, okay, anyway, so that's what got me all excited about that idea. The fact that it was a form of levitation I hadn't seen before, but makes total sense, you know?
Yeah, it does make a lot of sense that it should happen in a way sort of like this. You know, you have a thermal gradient that's going to give you a force, because the temperature is just a energy density, so a gradient over the temperature is going to give you a force. And so you just use it to get whatever it is you need to actually make the thing float. And it's interesting that nobody's been able to do it before, which I guess makes that low pressure even likely to be important, right?
Well, at these temperatures, I mean, you're only looking at a gradient here of 200 Kelvin. If you went more ambitious and you had something that, like a metal that was white glowing hot and really cold on the top, that's a whole other level, you know?
That's pretty good. I'm trying to think exactly how hot you could get the tungsten. Tungsten is used as a crucible for evaporation, which is a kind of deposition for thin films. So what they do is they put other stuff inside of the tungsten, and it boils off. And when it boils off, it floats onto the thing that you want to make, whatever it is. So you take little chunks of whatever it is that you want to put on your substrate, and then you just sort of evaporate. You boil the stuff inside of your crucible, and then the little particles just float up and stick to your substrate, and you're all happy.
I was looking up online the melting point. Tungsten has a melting point of 6,191 degrees Fahrenheit, or 3,422 degrees Celsius.
I mean, the way you'd heat up this tungsten crucible is with an electron beam, which you might not be able to do unless you're at even lower pressures than this experiment was at. But you need to have some atmosphere in there, right? You can't just, you know, you can't do this experiment at, you know, 10 to the minus 6 torr or 10 to the minus 8 torr or something like that, because then you're not going to have enough atoms for a thermal gradient to sit around and float your little tiny things. In fact, your little tiny things would get pulled out of the vacuum chamber. But they spent the end of this paper trying to show the little tiny things weren't floating because of the convective flow in the chamber, the photophoretic force on the objects.
Because that was like three orders of magnitude or smaller, right? They must have drained that chamber really slowly to keep those little babies in there. Maybe that's why they worked with the ice that formed on the nitrogen receptacles, because it was convenient.
Yeah, probably wasn't too bad, because to get to the pressures that they're using there, you don't need any really amazing equipment. You can use a rough pump to do that, so, or what we'd call a rough pump when I was doing UHV work.
Ultra high vacuum, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so that's probably not too much of an issue. I don't think it would create that much pressure. In fact, it looks like it had a pressure of much less than 25 piconewtons, because that's sort of the force that they were getting off of the thermal gradient, is 25 piconewtons. So whatever that pump pressure was, it had to be less pump force, excuse me.
Okay, I think that, is there anything else you wanted to cover? It's gotten to be that time, and I don't want to keep you. We've actually gone on quite a bit for this program.
Oh yeah, you're right, it is the witching hour. I must go.
All right, buddy, I don't want to get it witched, bewitched, or whatever it is that will happen to you.
Nice talking to you, Randy.
You too, James.